So again, we could maybe tie this back to the idea that you talked about a little bit earlier there with, personal responsibility, and also with the coming in there is the connection with what is known as, freedom, basically, and how we become more, more free, or a sense of that we're more free, because we're all, there are certain rules, of course, in this world that we live in. We're even confined to the body, so we can't, go where we want or do what we want all the time. So there's a, limit to it, as it were. But I see that responsibility, and again, becoming more aware and all of this, that is connected with freedom, and that is a personal thing. That, again, that's not something that you go out and wave placards for. In some
No.
instances, that help, of course, and changes need to be done, I guess, on that level. But I don't know. Would you agree on that? That this is a personal thing, and that responsibility is connected with freedom?
Absolutely, and I'm dedicated to that, and also to showing that the only kind of freedom that you can really have is attitudinal freedom, intellectual freedom. That's where it starts. That's the beginning and the end of it. Because in other ways, you're only relatively free, but even a chained man can be free. We're not free. See, legally, physically, right? Materially. We are in a world system that is very much unfree.
That's right.
And as I said to you in so many shows before, unfortunately, sad as it is, when you get into the studying the profiles of individuals, you discover that people are scared shitless of freedom. What they really want is freedom from freedom. But, again, let's leave that for other shows.
Yep.
What we have to understand right now is that, yes, the goal is intellectual, attitudinal freedom. People, for instance, you're not going to be able to do anything about good and evil. Those exist as absolutes in the world. Good and evil will be here long after you're gone. What you can do is you can change your attitude towards those realities. You can have a positive attitude towards evil and understand that what it is, just like the ancient Amanists of Egypt did and the ancient Druids did when they had Horus and Set. They didn't think of them, in the antagonistic ways that later on came about. It was a totally different understanding metaphysically of what Set represented. He represented the cathartic, deconstructive, catabolic, aspects of life, which I insist are absolutely important when you're dealing with the process of enlightenment. That if you think enlightenment is merely only a building up and a having and a getting and a wanting and a desiring and an accumulation, you're in for a big shock, because it's a deconstructive letting go, a cathartic, transformative, mutative thing that's also involved there. And this still hasn't sunken in to the New Age movement or to most of the churches. If we have time, can I read another passage
Yeah,
from the
please
book?
go ahead. Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's on freedom. Let me start it though with a quote from the great Nesta Webster. In her book Secret Societies and Subversive Movements, she says the final goal. Remember, we're talking about the Anubis going down the Thames. What is the door they're opening for us? Does this lead to a utopia or a dystopia? Okay, well, here's what Nesta Webster said over 100 years ago. She said the final goal of world revolution is not socialism or even communism. It is not a change in the existing economic system. It is not the destruction of civilization in a material sense. The revolution desired by the leaders is a moral and a spiritual revolution, an anarchy of ideas by which all standards set up through the 19 centuries shall be reversed. And I completely agree with this, that it is a war on consciousness. That war on consciousness will undoubtedly involve other forms of action on a physical, economic, right, religious, theological, theocratic, educational, sociological, etc., etc., even ecological. Look at Al Gore and his little,
Global warming, all of
another little
that,
freaking
sure.
cult, another sect of nonsense, right?
Yeah.
You're going to believe that is going to involve many other actions. But never forget that the central hub, the bullseye, is this war on consciousness. That's what it's really all about. And that's why it takes so long, because consciousness is not easy for them to chain completely.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? They can do it through drugs and other means, but that's not true slavery. They want you to come to the altar of sacrifice. Dragging you to it is no fun.
That's right. And I was pointing out there that the reason for global war, it's something out there all the time,
Global
external,
warming, the terminology, people won't be hard, it'll be difficult for people to understand until they have symbolic literacy. That lots of these terms are very subliminal. They don't just mean external threats. What's really warming up is the psychology of mankind, not the sociology or the ecology. those things, as Wilhelm Reich was able to show, are articulated to what happens in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important for them to direct you out. These are the false magicians, what they call, I call the sorcerers, whose job is to tap a stick and lead you away, like Pied Pipers, from where the real problem is. The real problem is with psychology. Wilhelm Reich, you know, Viktor Frankl, Carl Jung, you see, the great Alan Watts, all of these people knew that the problem was with consciousness.
Mm.
And any true teacher will always teach you that. The false leader will always teach you it's politics, it's sociology, it's ecology.
Mm-hmm.
They will lead you into those things. A little bit of good will be done, but they know that that little bit of good is a drop in the bucket. But everybody can pat their back and run for the champagne and go, hey, great, aren't we? Aren't we wonderful? We solved that crime, you know? Until the little Columbo appears and goes, question, sorry, something wrong with this, and throws a stick in the works. What about the bigger crime while you're all congratulating and eating the popcorn? Wait a minute, what about this greater crime that goes unsolved, you see? So anyway, the quote from my book is that I say here that the edifice of the New World Order is almost complete. It has been constructed brick by Masonic brick down through the centuries. Symbolically speaking, the last layer is already in place, and it only remains for the capstone to be set. When the time is right, the architects of doom will finally haul it into place. Once this towering Atenist pyramid of control is complete, the black light of the all-seeing eye will be cast down upon the world's enslaved men and women, marching like sleepwalkers beneath its black shadow. The men and women of the world appear eager to help construct freedom's tombstone, the altar upon which their own hearts will be torn out and offered to the blood-gorged gods. It is true that no slaves were involved in the construction of the real pyramid at Giza. That much has been historically proven. But the virtual pyramid of the Luciferian Brotherhoods exists entirely due to slavery, not of ancient Jews and Egyptians, but of all humanity. The unenviable task of revealing the origins and evolution of this greatest of mind control programs, Judeo-Christianity, may be justifiably considered futile in the extreme. However, should but one person be awakened after pausing to read our audacious graffiti upon the walls of our prison house, it is enough. Unlike the priests and popes presently in power, our quest is not to save lives or souls, but to save truth, so that it might nourish and sustain the spirit of humanity from the moment it finally awakens and enters into the world that has long wept, cried, and prayed for its arrival.
Yeah, that's beautifully said.
Well, we're waiting for freedom. Freedom is not about your conscious mechanism. Freedom is an absolute necessity for the true organic process of life to take place. Anti-freedom, or anything that stands against freedom, is anti-life. And as we said in the post-human world, and we've said in one of our early interviews on the future, on 2012, that you see, the more and more that the leaders, these dark, toxic people, operate in a dark, toxic, Luciferian, demonic way, the more they're waving a flag to nature, go, come and get me. Because nature is holotropic. Nature is holarchic. Nature is self-sustaining. Nature is equilibrium. The more that you operate out of sync with the natural forces, with freedom, the more that you're almost setting yourself up for destruction. So again, when people operate pessimistically, and of course when you look around in the world and you see so much ignorance, you can obviously feel very downhearted. Please think metaphysically. Please think philosophically. Please think higher than that. That it's remarkable the age in which you're living. And you better stand back and start really observing with the, you know, with the eye of a Kubrick, you know, start really looking and deeply observing the mysterious movement of truth and freedom.
Mm.
Because they have their own mechanism, they have their own movement, and that movement is sublime. That movement is the most beautiful thing that you can imagine. Watch it come into your life.
Mm.
Watch it come into the world. Don't sit there pessimistically with your head in your hands. Don't look at it's like they say in the movie Lost Horizons, don't look at the bottom of the mountain, why don't you try looking up at the top for a while?
Yeah.
It's your perspective, your attitude that matters. So never forget this, that attitudinal freedom starts with you. Your perspective matters. You can either sit with your head in your hands and lament, or you can raise up and you can start observing like a person watching a bunch of ants building their, you know, nest or whatever.
Mm.
Or the actions of a beautiful butterfly or an incredible racehorse. something incredible is taking place. You know, Pluto is moving, the archetypes are changing, man is questing, revelations are being made. They are pulling their headstone into place, but, you know, there's another miracle taking place as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this miracle, you need to have an eye for that as well, to be able to observe and take on board this incredible movement of freedom and truth that has its own particular ordinance, its own particular laws.
Mm.
And you can either live in ignorance of those and you can avoid it and ignore it and live in the darkness, or you can observe it and, like a small child, start to become educated again into this mysterious movement of truth, virtue, justice, and freedom that these tyrants, these Luciferians, know nothing about.
You said, basically, is the time right, you know, as they want to, as you say, cap their pyramid with this last, the capstone, and the radiance of the black sun, you know. And I guess what you're also saying there is that there is this other event taking place or happening, that that both of these kind of streams are converging here at some point. So I guess the question is the time right?
The time is always right. Again, it's not about time, it's about attitude. It's very good that when attitude starts to change, that the timing is right. You know, I believe the time is always right.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you're dealing with a lot of control. You're dealing with the mechanisms of control. And so people need to wake up to that. It's a twofold thing, remember. It's Horus and Set. At the one time, as you're building up and developing your own intelligence, you have to be aware of how these deconstructive forces are working to inhibit you from healing, from true healing. Because that's what this is ultimately all about. See, the Druids of ancient times, the ones in Ireland, healing was on their mind a lot. The great catastrophes that we've spoken of, you know, that wrecked the land bridges and destroyed the communities and sent people moving from the west to the east, these were gigantic cataclysms. So the ancient Druids and the Bards, you see, realized that their first duty was sort of to heal the earth. This is, I think, where a lot of the interest in geomancy came about. You know, mm-hmm. the ley lines, the synchronic lines, and so on. I think that was partly based on making sure that cities and towns and houses would be placed on, you know, places of geomantic strength.
That wasn't that severely damaged by
this
cataclysm?
And wouldn't damage the earth.
Mm.
See, it's not like today where all our ports and our cities, you know, are in terribly, terribly geopathic places.
Mm.
And are places that normally would not sustain human life at all. Like, you know, L.A., for instance, jumps to mind, you know. But there's plenty of others. Well, the Druids didn't operate in that way at all. They were very conscious about putting houses and their cities and certainly their religious centers on very, very active places of great power. And this will be found in all shamanic, you know, cultures. So healing is a very important thing. And today's modern shaman is interested in healing as well. He's realized that his own mind, his own spirit has been traumatized and brutalized by the barrage of lies, by the commitment to an inauthentic existence, an inauthentic life, just in order to do what? What are you doing that for? Just so you can earn a pay packet? Just so you can win the camaraderie of a bunch of other idiots? I mean, tell me what your motive is. You know, so you can just fit in, like David Icke says, you know, so you can just be penned in with the rest of them.
Mm.
You know, what's your motive for being this dumbed down and this tuned off and or this critical? You know what I mean?
Mm.
Well, critical of truth. Critical when people try to bring the truth your way, you shout them down or you give a bunch of pseudo-arguments, you see.
Mm, yeah.
So the world, the system, people in general are, you know, in a very sick state.
Of course.
And so healing, like I said about freedom and virtue, is a sort of an energy that is always there in the world, but you have to be open to it.
Mm.
You have to want to heal. So this is what the future is all about. You have to want to heal. If you don't, like I said, if you find that you cannot deal with the climb of the mountain and you find that you cannot deal with what you're seeing below you or that new vision of reality, then by all means go back to the village, because the number one and number two are going to take good care of you.
Hmm.
Just like Patrick McGoohan showed, right?
The prisoner.
You're going to have your three credit cards. You're going to have clothes to wear. Right? You'll have your maid. And you'll have all the food and the teas and the coffees, you see,
mm-hmm.
and the umbrella for the rain and everything. And the newspaper will, you know, print exactly what they know you want to read.
Yeah.
You see. And then every other so often, every decade or so, these mad psychopaths that rule you will want another crusade. Because remember, they're mad.
Mm-hmm.
So crusade has been part of their gig since the early days. Right.
Of
the Merovingians, the Carolingians, they just don't go on crusades because they, you know, feel like, you know, nothing to do. They love it.
Mm. Yeah.
We got them doing it now, haven't we?
Exactly. My point there again, going back to what is happening today, have the connection with the past. What do we see now in the, you know, in the Middle East, Iraq going into soon, Iran. I mean, we have Turkey on the borders going into Iraq now also. Ongoing. This is ongoing still, you know.
That's right. And it will continue to go on until people discover a very simple fact, and that this is the normal accepted behavior of psychopathic people. And you can either become infected by their epidemic, or you can, you know, operate differently, holistically, as a healing agent in the world. One of the things that I do go into in the book, I don't know if we've ever done a show on it, is the fascinating psychological profile of Akhenaten himself.
We've talked a little bit about that, you know, but yeah.
I think ever since I started looking into this whole question of the Atenists, you know, a long time ago, it's never ceased to interest me about what on earth is this man who denied an underworld, who denied darkness. You know, they all went to bed as soon as darkness fell.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Akhenaten had his own city. He moved away from Thebes because he hated the Thebans.
That's right.
He was desperate to get his own city, and they built it. It's called Akhetaten, or more correctly, Amarna.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and by the way, Amarna is very similar to the word Armagh in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's not get into that, but the word root thing is colossal, right?
Interesting, yeah.
But anyway, he moves to Armagh, and every single archaeologist who's ever gone out to either look at Armagh or dig up there has been struck by the horrible place. Mm. About the desert there is just so bright and so hot. It's probably one of the hottest places in Egypt. You know, I mean, it's just the most inhospitable place. And yet here's this man goes out and builds his big open, you know, city there because he was a sun worshipper.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, when they moved out to Amarna, were so crazy, man. Well, as soon as darkness fell, they all ran into the house and would sleep. They thought, you know, the night was evil.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't grasp this. I mean, he's also coming out of a 35,000-year tradition of Egypt where, you know, there was balance in everything. That the gods of the night and the gods of the underworld were worshipped as well, you see. He also moved his people to be buried at the Valley of the Kings. You know, he didn't want his people buried with everybody else again, because denying, he didn't want to really be near any place that was sacred to the gods of the underworld. So you don't have to be Sigmund Freud or Carl Jung to realize that, Jesus, there's something seriously wrong with a person whose personality is entirely of the light. If anyone's watched, you know, the work I've done on the connections between light and the ego, right? That the ego being, you know, fractured and separate than the self. And we don't acknowledge our shadow. We don't acknowledge our unconscious, you know, this old problem. But we live in an ego world, a persona world. Well, there you got a pharaoh ruling the world who literally is of that psychological profile.
Yeah.
This has been acknowledged not by me, but by all the archaeologists and the thinkers. They haven't gone into it as much as I would have liked, but it certainly has been noticed that this person was definitely deranged. Now, remember, let me add that 99% of the people who write on Akhenaten and on the Atenists are pro Akhenaten and pro-Atonist. They think he was great. They think he was the Christ before the Christ, the Jesus before Jesus, you know, the Moses before the Moses, who was just doing wonderful work, and all monotheism should bow in debt of gratitude to Akhenaten.
Yeah, there have been many of those, you know, History Channel, Discovery Channel documentaries trying to, you know, this enigmatic man, you know, who was he? And trying, it feels like they're trying to lift this up because, I mean, he was, I guess, thrown out of his own, you know, land, basically. So did you think that they recognized at that time that he actually was, you know, insane?
Well, after 17 years of the rule of a madman, they finally did realize it.
Yeah.
And they realized it so much that they wouldn't let him back. You know, they really, the whole land, that's what I'm looking for today's world, you see. In fact, my book is pretty much dedicated to the Amenists, you know, because I want to see something like this happen again. Not get rid of Akhenaten, but get rid of the legacy of Akhenaten and these, not just him, but his followers. You know, I describe Judeo-Christianity as Akhenaten's instrument of torture. Just like you make an Iron Maiden to put somebody in, or boiling oil or something. Man has been under Akhenaten's personal torture chamber, and it's called Judeo-Christianity. It's massacred millions of women. It has given us a negative energy towards animals and nature. It split man within his own psyche. It keeps us living in our ego. People who want to know what, well, this whole question of the ego. Do you know why you're in your ego? I mean, do you know that even the way the world system has been arranged contributes to the fact of why we're ego creatures as opposed to self? You know, shall we talk about the mysteries of melatonin, you see? And this whole cult of anti-darkness and anti-underworld that started off with monotheism, this cult of the sun. And I remember what we got to understand is that Atenism which is pouring forth from the White House and pouring forth from 10 Downing Street. And people will know these connections when they read the book. But can we understand that this Atenism is not true solar theology? So I'm not indicting the solar cult. This is an aberration of solar theology. Solar theology is many thousands of years old. It's just like the lunar cult or the solar cult, you see, or the Vulcan cult or the Dionysian cult.
Sure.
Nothing wrong with these cults in general. But groups, factions of elites within these cults, like Akhenaten, chose to go against tradition and to morph and warp solar tradition. So what we have now is a aberrated form of solar worship that I refer to as Atenism, that Christians will refer to as Luciferianism, without knowing a lot about what they mean, sadly, right? I hope my book will help with that. My work will help with that. But when you say Luciferianism, you're actually accurate. It's right. Because Lucifer was the son of the morning, and the son of the morning is the sun. So the biblical heroes, Solomon, I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Yep.
You know, but Abraham, you see, we're dealing with David, right? All of these characters, Jesus, they've all been rescripted to operate as very, very narrow patrons or archetypes of this warped sun. The Caesars were that. The bloody royals today are the same. It's not true solar worship. That's why the Essenes didn't accept Jesus. They were solar cult. They didn't mind a solar hero. They had ones called John the Baptist. The Mandaeans had one, you see. Mithras was one. Zoroaster was one. But none of them was quite as warped as Akhenaten and his gang of followers. So you have factions and divisions even within the solar cult. Amunism, the cult of Amun-Ra, which is incredibly ancient, is a form of solar worship. But those guys at Thebes, Memphis, and Heliopolis were balanced. For every solar god they had the feminine counterpart. Mut was one, vulture goddess Mut.
And there's no, you know, nothing similar if we're talking about Akhenaten and his...
Oh, you must be joking. The man, many of the women in his court had a prefix to their name, Mut. It was a common term. He forbade them all to even use the terms of the goddess in their names. He only broke the rules with one wife that he loved very deeply. It's called Kia. She is the prototype of the biblical Eve. Kia, either because she was so bloody stubborn, or that he just he just had such a soft spot for her, he allowed her to keep her true name, Mujnonet, which had the Mut in the beginning. You know what I mean? But everybody else was forbidden to show any pictures or altars or to those ancient gods. And the most hated of the gods was Amun-Ra, you see, and Osiris. And along with that gang, Horus would have been out. Ta would have been probably out, you see. Most of the pantheon, because Ta was the regional god of Memphis. Well, Jesus, they were the Amunists. There's nothing on earth that Akhenaten hated more than the Amunists. So any god that they worshipped, like Atum-Ra, right, or Amen-Ra, who was the national god of Egypt, or any of the outlying provinces, you see, who may maybe gone for the worship of Sobek-Ra, or Anubis, you see, or Hathor. Hathor, maybe allowed in. A little Isis would have been allowed. A little bit. And that's because all priestesses, even in Atenism, were priestesses of Isis. It's just, again, it's the way that works. As a certain amount of Isis symbolism would have been okay, because Isis also represented the Nile. I mean, the Atenists couldn't live in Egypt without the Nile, so look, you have to bend the rules somewhere, right? So at a certain point, Isis would have been acceptable, but not in other aspects. Certain aspects of Isis would not have been accepted, you see. So Atenism, I think, if given a longer role, I mean, he was only in power 17 years. Had they been in power longer, all of these gods would have been eradicated. You don't know the devastation that hit Egypt after when these psychopaths got in power.
And would you say that the sun also is attributed to the male principle, or you know, the masculine?
Masculine, not male. Let's get this very clear. We're not talking about men and women here. Women can be just as masculine as some men, and men can be quite feminine. We're talking strictly about the metaphysical principles of masculine and feminine, not about male and female. This is very much picked up, again, in Egyptian history, where you have Hatshepsut. Hatshepsut strode around as a transvestite, dressing in men's clothes, you know, with a whip, you know, the big pharaoh, and she was a female. You know, so we have a female there, you know, Cleopatra, again, the same idea, you know, really masculine. And then you have feminine pharaohs like Amenophis or Amenhotep III. He was a total freak, right? A real cross-dressing psychopath, right? So you have a bunch of, you know, feminine men, let's say, shall we say that, and masculine women, you know, I'm being exaggerative, of course. But what we're dealing with here is the question of balance between male and female, yin and yang. Very androgynous concept here. And the pharaoh was the example, the perfect embodiment of the unification of opposites. He's it. His rituals, his performance, the way he wore his hair, the way they wore the clothes, the rituals that they did, the times of the year that they did them in, who he married. You see, you couldn't become pharaoh in Egypt unless you had married what was known as the great royal wife. The female decided who was the pharaoh. If you were not married to the right legal female, you are never going to become the king or prince of Egypt. And this is why, you know, and these all these women, the top royal wives and the top princesses were priestesses of Isis. But you can't study Isis without studying the mystery of Osiris. That's because in the mythology, they're talking about balance to an extraordinary degree. The cult of, you know, the mysteries of the story of Isis and Osiris and of Horus is very much based on this unification of opposites. You know, the seeking for the missing phallus. Incredible. The missing phallus, because that goes back to an even earlier dynasty of Egypt in which the phallus was personified as the obelisk, which is like the phallic symbol that pierced the night sky. At that point, it wasn't Osiris's phallus, it was Jeb, the earth god Jeb, and his consort was the sky goddess Nuth. They're the first Adam and Eve, by the way. Adam and Eve is based on Nuth, the sky goddess, and Jeb, the earth goddess, that later gets retransmuted into Osiris and Nephthys, or you see, you also have each pantheon had different gods.
So this is way, way back.
Way back, going further back. Atum. But the one thing we have to realize is that in all the previous dynasties and all the previous teachings, whether you believe that Egyptian teachings was taken from Ireland or whether you don't, that's a separate question. But in all the ancient traditions of these countries, there was a balance. In fact, there may have even been a trinity. But there certainly was a duad, a perfect balance between, you see, the banks of the Nile and the gods that were worshipped. You know, in India, it was the same. Did you know, have you ever heard about the black Taj Mahal that was going to be constructed across from the white Taj Mahal? No, of course you don't, because they demolished that. They're a solar cult. An you know, those Hindus are all another warped solar cult. But, you know, Shah Jahan, the builder of the Taj Mahal, everyone goes there and goes, oh, that's just lovely. Look at that. Isn't that wonderful? Take a photo. They don't know that across the river, exactly geomantically placed, was an enormous black marble, was going to be a black marble Taj Mahal.
Was it ever built?
No. They ran out of money. And he was overthrown by his insane insane son, Aurangzeb, who was more fundamental Muslim, you see. He wasn't into all this Gnostic Sufi shit. You know, so they thought, okay, forget that. The man was going to put two Taj Mahals with a river running between like a kundalini. And that black would have been where you go to contemplate the other side of life. Not the negative side of life or the evil side of life. That's not. That's what you're getting when you are aberration. That's what you get post-Atonism. That's what you get post-Judeo-Christianity. That's what you get post-Luciferian. Now, anything dark, shadowy, feminine is evil. But the Gnostic, the mystic, the shaman, the druid knows that's nonsense. It's just another side of life. It's the mirror image.
Yeah.
It's not about which side you like better on the chessboard. Tell me, is night preferable to day? You know, is a dead rose more beautiful or less beautiful than a live rose? I mean, what are we? If you blink your eye, is one blink that closes the eye in darkness better than the blink that opens it to the light?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd think you're insane if you that's the stuff you'd hear from an insane person in a rubber room talking. I don't blink, man. It's really evil to blink. You know what? I keep my eyes totally open all the time. Watch me. I never blink. Because those little moments when the lid comes down and there's darkness, whoa, you don't want that. Then I'm under the power of the devil. You know something? I'm hearing the same crap. I hear the same nonsense, the same psychopathy, you see, from these people who have inherited this solar, this warped solar philosophy. So in Egyptology and the ancient studies, everything was balanced. A ritual done on this side must be balanced with a ritual on that side. You know, they got on Aleister Crowley's case because he had two temples in London. One was all in white. You know, and had just a nice altar and all of that. And across the town in another borough, he had a totally black altar. Of course, as soon as the media found out that, oh my God, Aleister Crowley has a black altar in London, all the papers dealt only with the black temple that was, you know, designed in black colors and black, you know, candles and the black veils hanging down. Not one journalist covered the fact, yeah, but he's got the opposite on the other side. The man is doing everything based on balance. You see what I'm saying? So Sheesh. Now, these controllers often understand this. So they have a certain amount of reverence for the gods of the dead, you know, and they also involve themselves in a certain amount of balance, because as psychopathic as their following is, as their path is, they're not stupid either. They've also realized that if you're too much sun, if you're too much ego, if there's too much of the one side, it's not going to happen. It's not going to be good. Mm. So they do have agents who operate on the other side as well. They've incorporated a certain amount.
I guess they know how the processes almost of you know, creation, the universe, yes, that there is this dichotomy, there is this two sides, and in order to again progress something forward, we have the, you know, the Hegelian dialectic and all of that, of course, that this is how you make stuff move, you know, move forward. So
that's right.
That's what you're saying here, I guess.
They've grown up. They've understood that. Okay, you know, Akhenaten and maybe two or three of the guys that came after him, you know, they're just way too far extreme. You know, but they're the pharaoh. That's allowed. That's okay. In practical terms, you know, we've got to run and do the dirty work. We can't just be as extremist as them. That's what these lieutenants understood, and that you have to balance. You know, you have to balance it, no matter what.
Could this have gone so out of balance? Because we hear this talk about, you know, the White Brotherhood and the Black Brotherhood. Basically, there is this ancient, you know, either if it's secret societies or actually some kind of other, you know, entities. We don't have to go there, but that this have gotten so out of balance that actually this very split has taken place, meaning that there is now these two sides fighting each other, and that this has been kind of the outcome of a very unbalanced, you know, life philosophy, basically.
Yes, that it is. They see, again, you have to look at it from two sides. They feel perfectly justified. Remember, we talked about in the previous show that, first of all, they think we're just their wayward, lost children, so they can treat us harshly. But they won't eradicate us completely because they still have a sort of fondness for us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They also might think that, look, we are just the mugs. We need to be controlled. Look, man is moving towards a utopia, and all you people who believe in national tribes and tribalism and nations, you just got to go. Our new world order will, you know, solve this problem, and we know you don't like it. See, they're fixated. I mean, if people watch the movie, you know, Things to Come, the H.G. Wells thing, you'll get an idea, you know, of how possessed, super possessed these people are. And with this idea that we're heading towards this great solar utopia.
Mm-hmm.
From their point of view, they believe that. And therefore, they feel that the end justifies the means. And they look at anybody who is disgruntled or anyone that, you know, sort of stands up against this as a deep enemy of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're thinking back at the Amonists. They're thinking, oh, we already defeated you guys. Where are you coming back with all of this stuff?
Mm.
The druids are gone. You know, we don't want any of this. We're doing what's for your own good. I'm telling you that these people never lie down. They're never finished. For every new advancement that humanity, true humanity, makes, they retaliate with something more. Remember, they're headlong now. There's no stopping them into virtual reality, into creating the global brain, for instance, right?
Yeah.
You know, the just like the internet, they're super interested in connecting all the minds of the human race.
Yep.
In some sort of, isn't that occultism? These are the same people telling you there's no such thing as occultism one minute, and no such thing as the unconscious. And then today they're talking about the global brain, hooking you all up like you're in the internet. I mean, this is this global suicide because, as I said, the human race is under danger. What makes a person truly human is under danger.
Yeah.
It's not that 2012 is the end of mankind. It's the end of mankind's history, as much as we have known. Huge changes are already taking place. Tomorrow, I predict the Vatican will turn around and literally discover a Christ-like being they're going to put in front of you.
They're
under threat.
Yeah.
And remember, they never sit, by the philosophy that they never sleep, they never sit down.
Mm.
Predict with me then what would be the next wonderful find to keep Judeo. I mean, we've already had a rise in evangelism in America.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Let's look at this. So Christianity has suffered a great decline in many years. I mean, last year it was the lowest turnout in Spain for the Pope's arrival.
Okay,
the Spanish could care less now about Catholicism, you see. So they notice this. They shake about this. They get into fear. They think, my goodness, what would happen tomorrow if all of Latin America start listening to what Father Rivera has said and the anti-Jesuits, you see? What happens if we're losing people? The young are getting on with their lives. You know, they're doing their thing. They don't want to. This is just so old for them. We might be losing the reins of control. They're terribly scared of this.
Yeah.
So then they go, oh, we found the tomb of Jesus. Didn't, haven't they done that in the last
very
month?
Recently, yeah, of
right,
course.
2006, yeah. Suddenly they find a tomb of Jesus. Not a single archaeologist of any repute confirms that, so they got to roll that one up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't
mm-hmm.
work. Tomorrow they're going to say, oh, we found the Temple of Solomon.
Well, yeah, again, there's always these reports coming out there, and even though they're interesting because they point to some, that they found something, of course, and you know, ancient monuments are always interesting to see, but... I guess what you're saying here is that they will look at anything that they find down there and say, oh, look, this is evidence for, you know, the historical, this is a historical fact that connects with the Bible, you know.
And that's right. You see, they don't discount anything, and the main agenda is to keep the status quo going. So they don't mind bending the rules a little bit. They were threatened by the Dead Sea Scrolls for reasons we've gone in other areas, and I have a huge section on that in the book as to what the real mystery of the Dead Sea Scrolls was. But then they're going to say, you know, they found a few shards of some temple. Doesn't mean it's the Temple of Solomon, but it makes great headlines in Time magazine.
Of course.
And since it's the Knights Templar who are running Time magazine, they're going to do whatever story you want them to do. They're all in bed together, right?
Yeah.
And so is most of the newspapers of the world. So if they tell you from the headquarters of Opus Dei or whatever that, hey, you're going to say this is the remnants of the Temple of Solomon, you better believe it's going to say Temple of Solomon discovered.
Yeah.
All right? No question about it. What you think or what the archaeologists say, that's unimportant. And tomorrow, as they find that more and more people slip off from this thing, or they think it's more of a relic, all they got to do is turn around in a sort of a scenic way and say, we've even found the bloodline of Jesus.
Well, there are people out there that say that they have.
Right.
They have the,
of course, there's always people like that.
Yeah.
Isn't it? There's people who say they're descended from the Stuarts. Just because nobody pays them any mind now doesn't mean that tomorrow, when the media network gets behind it, that they won't be really paying attention tomorrow.
Yeah.
If this sum result is more people in churches, more people going back to read the Bible, more people going back to Orthodox Christianity, believe me, they'll do it. If they can already have insane people like, you know, Van Imp and Hagee and all these evangelists who are just incredibly mad. You know, and most people, the sane people in the world, are laughing at these guys.
Mm.
But yet these people are funded with millions of dollars. Then let nothing surprise you tomorrow. And that if tomorrow they need to throw up a person who qualifies as a bloodline of Jesus type person, as we know, the Maitreya, you know, they have the whole thing of Maitreya,
yeah.
The betrayer,
yeah.
Or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So it's quite possible. Don't ever think for a moment that they're going to go down without a fight. And they know exactly how to push the button tomorrow to find out that, listen, we're going to reveal to you now why we have maintained the Vatican all of these years, why we've done this. Because secretly, without you knowing it, we have, in fact, been preserving the true bloodline of Jesus. Look how brilliant that would be. Instead of refuting all the people who talk about this cover-up, they actually turn around and go, oh, okay, guys, we'll go with it.
Mm.
What just happened within the last 2 weeks? The Vatican are now going to exonerate the Knights Templar.
That's right, exactly,
right.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that.
Me too.
Because it fits.
Very interesting.
Why would you just do that?
Yeah, and exactly on the 700-year anniversary also of their, you know, excommunication
right.
from the Catholic
all
Church.
All I hope is that they... also add the little footnote, and we funded them too, guys. Bet you didn't know that one.
Exactly.
Not that they will, but it wouldn't be wonderful if they just add that anecdote at the end.
Yeah.
Going, oh yeah, by the way, we started them, funded them, and ended them as well, so they're all our game. This is what people get to realize.
Mm.
So listen, if they're going to the... What on earth would possess them to wake up one day and go, oh gee, I feel real bad about what happened to the Templars. Let's do a big public thing and invite them to dinner.
Yeah, say we're sorry.
Yeah, we're
say
we're sorry. What does it matter?
Yeah.
Wait a minute, I thought there wasn't meant to be any Knights Templars around to say sorry to.
But there are.
But they must be. Right? So what's going on here? Why that date? Why even bring up the term Knights Templar?
Mm.
I thought you were the guys that, you know, didn't want to hide a hair of that. Too many movies have already exposed. Why? Is that because now when you exonerate them, you're giving the go-ahead for more movies to be made about them? For more editorials and newspapers and more journalists to go over there and go knock, knock, I would like to do a story with you. Aren't you the lead Grandmaster of the Knights Templar?
Yeah. And they're beginning to, again, the popularity are rising because of movies of the, like, the Da Vinci Code and all
that's
this,
right.
You know. So
next thing you're going to know is the Grandmaster's on Oprah Winfrey telling all. What's going on here?
Yeah.
Pope reveals all. You know? Well, they're using Templar crosses, Templar roses, Templar skulls and bones all over the Vatican. You go around for an ice cream in Rome, you're tripping all over them. I mean, come on, the symbols are everywhere. The whole blinking plaza of St. Peter's is designed like a Scottish thistle. Well, Scottish equals Templar. To anyone who knows anything about this subject, you say Scotland, you mean Templar.
Mm.
So it's a Templar thistle, because the Templars, when they spent time in Scotland, obviously adopted the thistle as their native symbol.
Yeah.
So this, okay, now the Vatican in Rome is shaped like a thistle. Listen, that's small potatoes. The Rome itself is aligned to Newgrange Tumulus. Let's get into the thistles. Let's go beyond that. The whole city is aligned to one of the most ancient monuments of the Druids. In which, guess what happens every summer, winter solstice, my friend? The sun and the moon enter into the same chamber. They cross the horizon. They rise on the summer. They rise on the winter solstice, right? The sunlight slowly, slowly, slowly crawls along the landscape until it hits the stone, the great standing stone that's standing outside the door of Newgrange. Just like something out of Indiana Jones, the shadow of the stone creeps closer to the sun door, the sun window of the tomb itself. And exactly at the moment, exactly at the same second as the shadow of the great standing stone hits the door, the light enters straight above, 7 feet high. It goes through this window and goes into the inner sanctum of the temple. So the shadow and the light enter precisely at the same time. This thing was developed thousands of years ago. Precise geometry, right? When it hits the inner temple, it falls right beside three spirals. Right? Now, first of all, it's entered into an inner room, which is representing your inner mind, your inner chamber of your being. Or people can take it sexually, that it represents the phallic sun going into the vagina, which is all absolutely legitimate. But it can also represent the sunlight of knowledge. Remember, they're solar cult people. The Druids were not a warped solar cult. They were a balanced solar cult. Because on the night following the sun's entrance into Newgrange, the moonlight also enters in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that was considered that the goddess has now arrived. But the three spirals on the back of the chamber, and it lasts for about 17 seconds, that sunlight, and then it vanishes. So the Vatican and Rome is aligned with an ancient temple of Ireland, is already staggering, if you think about it. And it's aligned to a temple that happened to have this phenomena take place, which is the androgyny, the super nucleation of the opposites of light and dark. You want to know why these people are empowered? That's the reason. Because they are symbolically awakened. They're using the celestial forces, they're using numerology, astrology, Kabbalah. They're using all of that stuff. They've designed their cities based on it. Their thinking is apart by it. Their deeds of operation are based on the sidereal zodiac, you see. It's really profound what they're into. And this is the knowledge. Why I'm into this is because this is the same knowledge that should be given to worthy human beings. Shouldn't be given to the unworthy. That's not what I'm saying. But I got a belief that the unworthy couldn't use it anyway because they couldn't pass the first trials that this knowledge requires. This knowledge is sacred. It is heavy. It does demand a certain attention and a certain, you know, sacredness.
Wow. So, I mean, again, all of this that we have been talking about here and so much more, of course, is included in your new book, The Irish Origins of Civilizations. Yeah. For people who are, you know, interested and want to, you know, get a copy, is there a way people can you know, pre-order? How does that work? Is it out yet, or do you know when it's going to be out?
Next month. It's been out of my hands for a couple of months because we've just been editing it and laying it out. And remember, it's two-volume set. It's a two-volume set. The first one is, volume one, is The Servants of Truth, which is about the Druids. And the subtitle is Druidism, Traditions and Influence Explored. So it's just for people who may be new to the subject of Druidism. This book cuts through a lot of the lies that have been told in other books. The first thing that this book does, I think, in my mind, is that it really puts on record the genocide of the Druids, which has always been a footnote of history. If you open a book on Druidism or Celts or goddess worship or Ireland, you will always hear about the destruction of the Druids, but you'll read about two lines and that's it. It rarely gets more than a paragraph, and I'm serious about that because, believe me, I've read almost every book there is out on that subject. Some of them have been written recently. They're all good books and everything, but when it comes to the actual destruction of the Druids, you'll hear about, oh yeah, the Druids, flee, they go to Anglesey, Romans come, kill them off. It's no more than two or three lines. My God, how many books have been written about the Native American Indian destruction?
Many, I guess.
How many books have been written about, you know, the colonizations of like Africa, you see, or Pol Pot, his genocide over there, you know what I mean? And so many genocides that have happened in the world, Haiti. How can it be? Really, it's sad. You know, Lenin and the destruction of the White Russians has been written about by volume after volume after volume. No book has ever written about the genocide of the Druids in the way that it should be handled. How many books have been written about Cortez and the conquistadors going to South America and massacring, butchering?
Many
book
more.
After book after book after book. Whole chapters dedicated to it. No one has written about the genocide of the Druids, except as a passing footnote. That is not good enough for me.
Yeah.
So the first book deals with who are the Druids, what did they teach, how did Ireland and England arise from the ruins of Atlantis? The book is about the Age of Catastrophe. Again, my favorite and thing that I'm most passionate about is the bringing back of the work of Commons Beaumont, you see in MacDari. It's about that too. The second book is called Akhenaten, The Cult of Aton and the Dark Side of the Sun. That's all about what we've been talking about, the Luciferians, the sorcerers who replaced the magicians.
Mm.
Okay, it is not a book that loves Akhenaten, so you can put it on a shelf different than 99% of the books on Akhenaten. Okay, mm-hmm. It doesn't fall into that category. If you're lionizing Akhenaten and you've been, you know, buying into all of the stuff that you've been taught about him, this is not a book that you're going to enjoy at all, because it really goes into the roots of Judeo-Christianity and to all official religion and shows where it came from. It shows what the secret societies have really been guarding, so that when we point fingers at Zionists and all, we point fingers at Masons, you know, we could be wrong. We could be erroneous. You know, let's really understand what the symbols on the dollar bill and the pyramid are, because it's slightly not accurate. You know, I'm glad that this subject has come to light in the last lot of years, the conspiracy people have been writing, but there's a lot of errors, you know. They're pointing in the right direction, but we need to become more specific. As every year goes by, we'll learn more about the specifics of who this symbolism really belongs to.
So you're adding here to this subject.
Vastly, because I'm completely convinced, absolutely 100% convinced, that we're not going to understand the world we're living in without an understanding of the ancient history.
Mm.
And the subtitle of the second book is The Destruction of Druidry and the Rise of Judeo-Christianity, connecting these things. And I talk about some fantastic authors, you know, bring up a lot of information, just like the stuff on Minoan Crete. In fact, if people want to know more about the salt lines, this question of the great geomantic grid, the Templars and how they built on it, there's an appendices online that they need to go to on the Irish Origins of Civilization site. So you go to irishoriginsofcivilization.com, click on appendices and go to number 4. You'll see it there. It says a look at the Minoan. And this deals with the work of Butler and Defoe and other people we've been talking about on this particular program. And also another note is that all the appendices of the Irish Origins book, or at least 90% of them, have been put online.
Okay.
Free of charge. Okay, they're not in the book. Because these appendices are a lot of contributions for the people have sent to me throughout the world, who've known that I'm working on this subject. And I'm really indebted to a lot of these contributions. Well, most of what I do is collaborative anyway. And so because these appendices will be an ongoing and frequently updated appendices, I chose not to put it in the book itself and put it online. So people need to frequently revisit.
That's great. I mean, that's perfect. That's just what you want today, that they're in a way almost the... You know, the additions keep coming to that, to those appendices.
There. I've always said, you know, from day one about this book, when talking about the West to East movement or any of the things that this book deals with, is that I am only jump-starting this subject again. I don't know all there is to know about it. I've just, you know, studied it for 25 years. I'm convinced about a certain amount of things, but this is just jump-starting a subject that needs to have a, you know, a new report every so often. You know, we need again to sit down and find out what do we know now about it. Because every week, as you say, more stuff is coming in.
It is.
I'm constantly being sent fantastic information from every part of the world. Australia, New Zealand, you know, you name it. People from Finland, people from Russia saying, hey, you know, I've got some fantastic stuff from Belgium. And I've got amazing stuff from Bulgaria, believe it or not. There's a Bulgarian connection to the Celts.
Wow,
that's very strong. There's a connection to Armenia. Do you know that the civilization of Armenia is over 10,000 years old?
It's totally fascinating. I've been fascinated with Armenia for a long time.
And that it's connected to the Irish. That many of the artifacts, the little jewelry that they found there, there's an incredible likeness to the you know, Celtic or that so-called Irish. Well, it makes sense because north of Armenia is Scythia, you know, and Parthia, places where these so-called Celtic peoples hung out a lot. And remember, again, like we said on the show about the land bridges, please don't, when we're talking about Greece and Crete and Thracia and Ireland and England and, you know, what do we just say, Armenia, we're not talking about what you see on a map today. Get out of thinking about that it looks like the map or that they even have the names
Exactly.
Well, that we use today.
That's right.
That's another form of mind control that's been handed down to us, you know. China's ancient name was Cathay. You know, England's ancient name is Albion. You know.
Yeah,
there's a whole different, you know, what, Sverige, Sweden, you know, goodness knows. Oh, Sverige is something of the goddess, isn't it?
Svea, that's we, and Rige, that's Reich or Rike. So it's Svea, Reich, basically. That's what
amazing.
It means.
So Sver is a goddess name.
Yeah, Svea.
And Riga or Reich is like the German for Reich or for kingdom.
Yeah, kingdom.
So Sweden is called the kingdom of the goddess, the kingdom of the queen.
Yeah, basically.
What about that?
Translate it.
Well, the band Queensryche will be really happy to hear that.
that's right.
And some Nordic roots there. Yeah, in fact, they have a song called Lady of something or other. It's just escaped my mind now, but they have a lot of feminine symbolism in their songs. Lady of the Reich or Queen of the Reich or something like that. So there you go. The whole of Sweden then is named after the goddess. Norway, you know, we've got this goddess symbolism. Remember I said earlier that Ireland was named after three goddesses. Eri. E-R-I.
E-R-I, yeah.
E can be interchanged with A, so you have Ari or Ari.
That's right.
Right? Ari or Ara in Egyptian is the lion. How many times have you seen the female with a lion in the Britannia? Britannica symbol, right?
Yep.
Britain, Britannia. They have the female goddess sitting on a throne with a trident and a lion beside her, the Lion of England. It all goes back to Druidic philosophy. One day we'll maybe do a show on the entire Druidic symbolism once the book is published. Because, by the way, the book is also highly illustrated. There's over 100 images in there where we decode symbolism. And specifically the chapter, The Scarlet Thread, is one for people to really focus on because it has enormous symbolism in there, a lot of pictures. And the book will be out next month. People can sign up and send me a personal notice. Now, the demand for the book is enormous, so you have to email me to say, give me your email and your and name, because then I will put you on the short list, so you'll definitely get a book, because we could run out of stock.
Yeah.
So you'll get a book, but if you don't want to wait long, then you know notify me ahead of time, and you'll go on the short list of the people who get books first.
Perfect. So, I mean, head on over to IrishOriginsOfCivilizations.com. Civilization, I should say. IrishOriginsOfCivilization.com. And if you click on Purchase Book, you have a link right there to your email address. Yeah. Perfect. Also, do check out MichaelTessarion.com, of course, for all of his other websites that they have out there, and OriginsAndOracles.com for his DVD series. And again, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the program. It's a pleasure having you here.
Same here, Henrik. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in, and big thanks again to Michael for coming on. Also, thanks to Frederick behind the controls. Red Ice Creations Radio will be back on Sunday. Until then, take good care.
It's hard when folks can't find their work where they've been bred. When I was young, I always thought I'd bide midst roots and corn. But I've been forced to work in town, so here's my litany. From Hull and Halifax and Hell, good Lord, deliver. When I was caught in Mary Jane, the old squire, he says to me, I've got no rooms for wedded folk, choose whether to go or to stay. I could not give up the girl I loved, so to town I was forced to flee. From Hull and Halifax and Hell, good Lord, deliver me. I've worked in Leeds and Huddersfield, and I've earned some honest brass. In Bradford, Keighley, Rotherham, I've kept me bairns and lass. I've travelled all three ridings round, and once I went to sea. forges, mills, and coal and boats. Good Lord, deliver me. I've walked at night through Sheffield lines. 'Twas just like being in hell, where furnaces thrust out tongues of fire and roared like the wind on the fell. I've sammed up coals in Barnsley pit with muck up to my knee. From Barnsley, Sheffield, Rotherham, good Lord, deliver me. I've seen fog creep across Leeds Bridge as thick as the Bastille Sioux. I've lived where folks were stowed away like rabbits in a coop. I've seen snow float down Bradford Beck as black as ebony. From Hunslet Hall, Beck, Whipsy Stack, good Lord, deliver me. But now that all our children have gone to the country, we've come back. There's 40 miles of heathery moor twixt us and the coalpit stack. And as I sit by the fire at night, I'll laugh and shout with glee. From Hull and Halifax and Hell, the good Lord